ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What is it about reading and the act of reading that some people find unsettling?
Yeah, what is it about reading? It seems almost quaint that in this day and age when the internet is awash with every known vice and fewer people are actually reading books, that literature should present a moral challenge for our times. But in the US, more and more books are being banned and challenged. Some are asking, is the right to read in trouble?
The right to read is a belief that every one of us has the right to read what we want, when we want it.
But this attack on reading, it's not just happening in the US. Books are being challenged all around the world in places that are culturally and historically distinct. And yet, this is something they have in common. I'm Sarah Lestrange, and I've been reading professionally as an arts journalist for the ABC, the National Public Broadcaster. I've been doing it for almost 20 years, and I'm shocked and confused when I discover that some of the books that I cherish and love have been banned in different parts of the world. Although, of course, the real test isn't for the books we love, but for the ones that actually destabilize our worldview. And when you think of literary censorship, I have this image of the towering book infernos of Nazi Germany. And yes, books are still burned, but a lot of the time, they're taken out of circulation in this mundane, bureaucratic flick of the pen. There are warnings too, of course, from the past. 19th century German author Heinrich Heine cautioned that wherever they burn books, they will also, in the end, burn human beings. In this series, Banned Books, over 5 episodes, I'll be taking a look at specific literary works that have been banned and challenged around the world to find out, well, why they've stood out to the censors and how it fits with the history of censorship in these countries. We'll travel to the US, of course, China and Iran, no surprises there, India, and yes, Australia too.
The scary thing is if we keep going, there just may be very few books left.
That's the case with most of the people who want things banned, right? They've never read it.
It's the lone nut job somewhere with a knife or a gun that you have to worry about.
Do you think it's reasonable for any of these authors to go to jail?
No, absolutely not.
Writing about sex, politics, religion, you need to be very careful.
In this world tour of recent book bans and challenges, I'm going to start in America, because this is the land of the free, isn't it? And yet it has an epidemic of book banning.
There have been 41 states and 247 school districts that have been impacted by book bans since July 2021. That affects millions of students, millions.
Casey Meehan is the Program Director for Freedom to Read at PEN America. This is a human rights organisation that defends the rights of writers to free expression in America and around the world. With the rise of book banning, PEN America has tracked all of the book bans across the country. And what they've found is startling. They've found that the states of Texas, Pennsylvania, and Florida have the most number of book bans out of the whole country.
What we are seeing is significant pressure from legislative initiatives as well as extreme groups that are really heightening the amount of book bans playing out in public schools and public libraries across the country. So we certainly see, you know, just a scale and a magnitude of book bans that is a bit unprecedented than what we've seen in recent modern history.
One of the books that's topping the book ban charts in the US since it was published is The Hate U Give. This was the debut young adult novel of Angie Thomas. Angie grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, and the book draws on her life experiences of growing up in a poor black neighbourhood. The Hate U Give is a book that I loved when I read it in 2017 because the main character, Star, is one of the great literary heroines of fiction. She's smart, funny, and complex. Star is 16, she's African-American and lives in a poor neighbourhood, although she attends a private school. And I spoke to Angie Thomas about the book when it came out, and this is how she describes Star.
Star is a combination of so many young girls that I knew in my neighborhood and even little bits and pieces of me. We both love sneakers and Tupac and the Fresh Prince. So I wanted to show the girls in my neighborhood themselves, and I wanted to show them just how amazing they are. Because so often when you're talking about neighborhoods like ours, the bad is what often gets the attention and not the good.
But since The Hate U Give was published in 2017, a wave of bans and challenges have been aimed at this book in the US to get it out of the hands of teen readers. PEN America has tracked its banning since 2021.
Yeah, so Hate U Give is often a frequently challenged book. PEN America counts when it's been banned. And we know it's been banned 33 times. So again, 33 districts.
That's a lot of people, given a district in the US can have between 500,000 and 1 million people. So multiply that 33 times.
Within a given district, there could be multiple schools, multiple libraries, you know, hundreds of copies of this book. So the actual like physical impact that this ban is hard to quantify.
Angie Thomas was inspired to write The Hate U Give as a result of the burgeoning Black Lives Matter movement that rose in 2013 after a wave of unrest at the acquittal of police officers involved in the shooting death of African-American teenager Trayvon Martin. Angie was also moved by the stories of other police shootings, including of Michael Brown and Oscar Grant.
I often tell people this is not new. The only reason it feels new is because we see it more so. I was hearing about things like this when I was a kid growing up, but we never saw it. It was always word of mouth. There was never any proof. These cases have been happening. Police brutality is not new. What's new is social media. We can now know about names that we wouldn't have known about before. We can now see proof of it. So it's just putting it in our faces more and giving us no choice but to look it dead in the eye.
In the novel, The Hate U Give, 16-year-old Star and her friend Khalil are driving home after a party when they're pulled over by the police. They're asked to get out of the car, but Khalil, a young black man, reaches for something. The police are spooked and he is shot and murdered. He is unarmed.
It's a very real issue we have in America right now. That's why we say Black Lives Matter so much. A lot of times in these cases in America, these young black men are often blamed for their own deaths. Michael Brown is often blamed for his own death. Or people will say, well, it was justified because he was a criminal. Or same with Oscar Grant. Oscar Grant was an ex-con. And people tried to use that to justify the loss of his life. And so often young black men are called thugs. If they're dressed a certain way, it's automatically assumed that they're a thug or that they're in a gang. Well, I know young men who resorted to gangs. I know young men who resorted to selling drugs. And I know why they did. So I wanted to show the whys, because it's easy to look outside and say, oh, you just did that because you could. But you don't know the situations. You don't know the mindset. You don't know the environment. I wanted to show the why. I wanted to take something that's so often seen as political and make it personal. And in doing that, I had to give the personal accounts. I had to go beyond the titles and the stereotypes. So as a writer, that's always what I want to do. And with this book, I wanted to show why a young man like Khalil would end up in the situations he ends up in. And I wanted you to understand it and hopefully get some empathy for this young man. So that when you see Trayvon Martin on the news, maybe you'll have some more empathy for him than you did originally.
One of the criticisms of The Hate U Give is the way the police are portrayed. But Angie Thomas says she's trying to write about a complex situation.
I often have to point out it's not an anti-police book. It's an anti-police brutality book. There's a big difference. And as someone who has law enforcement in my family, it was important to show that. And that question that Star has is often a question I ask myself. And it's a question I ask my relatives in law enforcement. Do you really want justice? And for sometimes for them, it's complicated.
As I mentioned, I loved this novel.
You know, it's about a young woman and she's trying to do the best she can in a difficult situation. We learn a lot from her about empathy and courage. She has to learn to speak up and not be silent about the shooting death of her friend. So why has it been banned so much in the US? Casey Meehan from PEN America says it has to do with a backlash to theory.
The Hate U Give was predominantly moved based on challenges to, I'm putting in quotes, like divisive concepts, rhetoric, or anti-CRT campaigns where they were removing The Hate U Give because of its depictions of police brutality and the protagonist being a young Black female.
And in case you haven't heard this term, CRT, it refers to critical race theory, which understands racism as a function of institutional power, not individual bad luck. And the term divisive concepts, it relates to discussions of race in the context of social inequality. So if you think about it, just having a protagonist who's Black is enough to have your book banned because it can be considered, quote unquote, a divisive concept. What does that say to all the Black kids in public schools? That their stories aren't important, that just by existing, they are considered divisive.
Angie Thomas joins a list of authors whose books are targeted because they offer rebuttals to racism.
Tracy D. Hall is a scholar, and she's also the former executive director of the American Library Association. This is an organization that advocates for all libraries in the US. And Tracy says that current book bans are part of a long history of censorship in the US.
In the US, we've had various eras of censorship, and some of that started, you know, right at the beginning of the formation of the nation in the 17th century when there was the banning and the censorship of books that might have veered away from completely puritanical readings of the Bible. And then later, during periods of enslavement and post-enslavement of African peoples in the US, you had deep restrictions on learning to read because there was a fear that learning to read was tantamount to giving someone their freedom and also would make people disagreeable with enslavement. And that was, you know, I'm actually quoting there. And then, you know, of course, we had the Senator Joseph McCarthy era in which he almost unilaterally began a campaign of censorship and banning books that he thought were un-American. And so today, when we think about book banning, we are building on those histories, right? Which is why book banning is still so racialized in the U.S., which is why it targets many books written by Black and Indigenous and people of color, and also books that talk about civil rights. But increasingly, it's also turning towards rising voting blocs as well, new immigrants, and very specifically and really severely clamping down on the lived histories and the stories of LGBTQIA individuals. But I wanted to share sort of that progression in that timeline because we have to understand that contemporary censorship really is building on a history of censorship that has been alive and well in the U.S. as long as the country has been that.
So far on Banned Books, you've heard about how books that address racism in the US, like The Hate U Give, are more likely to be banned in certain states. Let's drill down now and look at how these book bans actually operate on the ground. As a library and reading advocate, Tracy D. Hall has followed the situation closely.
The vast majority of book bans that we're seeing are happening in schools, right? So about 48%, either at the level of the school curriculum itself or the school library. And then we have the next largest percentage happening in public libraries.
Hopefully a district or a library system would have a process for which that challenge would move forward. So an individual challenges a book, it goes through a reconsideration process. Usually a committee would review the book and then make an assessment on the book based on the book as its whole, as well as its literary merits. When that happens, books often stay.
But the sheer volume of the challenges places a large burden on the administration of public school libraries. Casey Meehan from PEN America.
there have always been traditional ways to challenge and question books in public schools and public libraries. But what used to be a kind of an individual objection to a specific title is like a thing of the past. Now we're watching challenges filed en masse. So it could be an individual who's submitting 200 challenges, you know, to the one school district. So that school district is now tasked with what could be an extremely burdensome process if they're following best practices of like convening committees, having every book read in its wholeness, making sure that they have the 200 books available to every member on the committee to go about reading. So there are some real significant burdens that we're seeing play out, both in terms of, you know, actual costs, financial costs, as well as time spent to go through these, you know, increasing and sort of the challenges being filed en masse.
As a hand-on-the-heart advocate for reading and libraries, Tracy D. Hall has actually attended many book ban hearings, online and face-to-face. And her takeaway is that they're politically motivated by people who often haven't even read the book.
We have seen the rise of groups that are closely affiliated with very conservative politicians. It usually is a small group of people. And, you know, some of those entities, Moms for Liberty is a good example, are really targeting schools and public forums and identifying individuals that they think will be easy targets or easy prey for really proselytizing them. And sometimes you're seeing hundreds of passages from hundreds of books that are just copy and pasted into emails saying this book contains this objectionable passage for us, and this book is in this school, or this book is in this library. You know, if you really care about your child, or if you really care about morality, or if you, you know, are someone who is, you know, a religious person and pious, you will object to that book being available.
These are ideological attacks on books held by libraries, which can be seen as an attack on the institution itself. And not surprisingly, it's creating a climate of fear.
We're seeing legislative initiatives that are criminalizing librarianship or threatening loss of licensure for educators, really leading to this pretty well established system of fear and confusion and intimidation. So books can be removed sometimes through a direct mandate, but oftentimes we're also seeing books being removed in an environment of extreme caution or out of extreme fear of what could happen if they kept those books.
Book bans in US schools and libraries haven't just been directed at new works. The fiction of Nobel laureate Toni Morrison, one of the great writers of the English-speaking world, has been the subject of bans and challenges, and so has Alice Walker, the author of the wonderful book, The Colour Purple.
What I'm alarmed by and afraid of is that newer generations may not be able to read those masterworks as readily. And so the community that stands to be hurt oftentimes is the author, yes, especially if they have... they don't have a huge body of work. But I think what I'm worried about are young people, particularly in the South, in rural communities where we see unchecked censorship often, where there are limited bookstores, where small libraries may not feel that they, you know, have the freedom to put books on shelves that have been challenged. To me, it is the people in those communities, the young people especially, but anyone in those communities, to be robbed of the right to read Morrison or Walker is a travesty.
Tracy D. Hall is worried. She's worried about a lot of things, but about the long-term effects of these bans on writers and readers.
There definitely is a correlation between something, you know, being censored, a book being censored, text being censored, and an immediate kind of like rise in interest. But I think the long-term impact is something that we don't talk about. That what we don't talk about is the shadow banning, right? Which occurs when maybe someone newer in their career, either as a writer or an editor or a librarian or a teacher, decides that they don't want to pursue a text or a topic because they don't want to get in trouble or be called out. So although we don't have any statistics right now on that, we can believe that someone who may feel that they could be harmed or their career could be harmed in the long term by a book being censored is going to think twice about what they write or buy or circulate or put on display in a library or bookstore.
It's not just American works that have been caught up in the groundswell of book bans about race and racism in the US. The Australian author Maxine Beniba Clark's award-winning children's book, The Patchwork Bike, has literally been taken away from children, although ultimately it wasn't officially banned. At issue are Van T. Rudd's illustrations of African children dancing on an abandoned police car. And in response, Maxine had to write about it, and she's written a poem about book bans called There's a Shelf in the Library. Here's some of it.
There's a shelf in the library you've probably heard that's political proud. They say it's reserved for the bigger kids who are more mature, but I tell you, there's ripping tales galore. There are tales about protesting things that are bad, books that were banned by complaining dads, and by mums who don't think we should see the true world, who think some love is bad and pink is for girls. There's a shelf in the library Miss Lara protects. They're sacking the teachers. We're scared she'll be next. That shelf in the library we defended with love and fought hard for our right to read what we want. We will keep making shelves all over this land of books they won't stock and of books that are banned. And shelf by shelf, our whole libraries we'll raise, and the shelves in those libraries, what a great world they'll make.
Of course, a lot of the justification for book bans is the need to protect our children, something we all want to do, isn't it?
I mean, of course, there are some things that we need to protect our children from. The important thing is that alongside different texts, kids are taught to be discerning, you know, and when kids read books, I think we have to have faith in kids as well. They will ask if they don't understand something, or they will discuss something with a peer or a parent or a teacher, or they'll have a class discussion. And I think accepting diverse books and not banning them is an indication that diversity of thought and you know, diversity of background and diversity of opinion is valued. Banning things, it impacts critical thought and the ability to actually encounter something and decide for yourself whether you like it or not.
I began this episode by saying how quaint book bans seem when you think about what's available online and that people aren't reading that much anyway these days. But I had this aha moment when PEN America's Casey Meehan pointed out that book bans are not just an attack on writing and ideas, but on the pillars of democracy itself.
There have always been historic efforts to destabilize and dismantle our public institutions. So I think there are, you know, kind of really organized efforts to push against our public institutions as a place that serves all students or all patrons of a library system.
So, next time you're at the library, why don't you pick up a copy of The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas and find out for yourself what you think of the book. Next time in this special series on banned books, I'll look at one of the most famous books that has been banned in the last 40 years, The Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. Banned Books is presented and produced by me, Sarah Lestrange, and the supervising producer is Rhiannon Brown.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.